Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It was 21 years ago that an ugly incident in one of the world's beautiful cities caused an international outcry. Amy Beal, a young American Fulbright scholar and anti-apartheid activist, was pulled from her car in racially divided Cape Town, South Africa, and was savagely murdered by a mob. Ironically, she was heavily involved in the cause of racial equality and killed by those equally committed to that cause. Who would have blamed Amy's devastated parents for demanding both justice and death for her killers? But it did not work out that way. In fact, Amy's mother, Linda, now works with one of her daughter's killers through a foundation in Amy's name, the Amy Beal Foundation. Its mission is to prevent violence through reconciliation through a series of youth programs. Linda Beal is in studio with us. Also here is Tobiko Penny. He is a project manager for the Amy Beal Foundation and a man who was convicted, imprisoned, then pardoned for Amy's murder. We're also joined by Manfred Jacobs, a South African corrections officer who was personally acquainted with Nelson Mandela and also was one of the corrections officers in the prison in which Tobiko was held. Thank you all so much for being with us. Linda, good to see you again. Tobiko, good to see you. We got together about 6 or 7 years ago.
We did. Thank you for having us back.
Well, it's good to have you, and we'll talk about why you're here a little bit later. But I'd like to review some of this story. Linda, I'll start with you.
Okay.
I know it's been 20, 21 years. Still has to be difficult, but tell us about what Amy was doing in South Africa at the time of her death.
She was doing exactly what she wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, she graduated in Stanford from Stanford with a degree in international relations with an emphasis on sub-Saharan Africa, went there to the sub-Saharan area and observed the Namibian peace treaties, all these things that, okay, Amy, what are you doing next, you know? Mm-hmm. But it was her commitment to human rights, and as my kids and many others in the 80s learned about what was happening in South Africa under the apartheid system, they became very committed to the cause. She graduated from Stanford in 89 with Free Mandela on her hat. And after some opportunities and whatnot, she was able to get a Fulbright grant to go and actively get involved with the work with the new Constitution, Bill of Rights, and be proactive in a very positive way.
She had obviously a wonderful life ahead of her.
She did. She had a wonderful life for 26 years, too, that we do celebrate.
What happened?
Well, you know, she was about ready to come home. She had just applied and received a Jacob Javits Fellowship to get a Ph.D. in African Studies, and was finishing up her thesis on women's issues and the transformation, all this stuff, this academic stuff. But she loved the people, and people wanted to spend time with her and do things with her, and she had friends that she was working with at the University of the Western Cape, which, by the way, was a non-white university mm-hmm. set up for non-whites, as South Africa was so constructed. And a couple of her friends needed a ride home. Cars, transportation, to me, are still a form of apartheid, you know. So she said, well, okay. And she was on her way home, and it was prior to the elections, and there were young people that were incited in their own political activity, which was not part of the ANC, not part of Nelson Mandela's negotiations and all that. They felt that, Tobiko can tell you, but they felt that the ANC was a sellout. They were giving away African land, et cetera. So they had sort of a couple of operations going on and trying to make the townships ungovernable. And the townships out of Cape Town were very active politically, and when they decided that maybe white people were their oppressors and they had a slogan, one settler, one bullet, and whatnot, a collision happened one afternoon when they were going about their political activities. Stoning a truck, creating, you know, this sort of chaos. And Amy's white face appeared, and she represented to many an oppressor. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, when mobs get together and are angry, have been incited, and feel, you know, they have been wronged for generations, definitely her life was somewhat you know, insignificant. And it was sad for all. I don't think it was – it was sad for us. It was sad for the young people involved. It was sad for their parents. But understandable.
Mm-hmm. That's hard, I think, for a lot of people to digest. You're saying that, the mother of Amy Beale. Just to set the stage and the chronology of all this, I think Nelson Mandela had been released from Robben's Island probably 1990. Was that right?
Yeah,
he was out. He was out.
He was out of prison. He was actually released from the prison where Manfred works. Yeah.
And he was released out of prison.
Yes.
But apartheid, the various law changes that would have eliminated at least most of that. Had not yet been enacted. Is that correct?
They were preparing for the elections. Yeah. It was August of 93. The elections did take place in April of 1994. In fact, you know, Amy was working towards those elections. She wanted them to happen. So when people came and interviewed us and said, aren't you angry? Aren't you mad? We'd say, but these elections have to take place.
Mm-hmm. But this was a time of transition, obviously,
yeah. Oh,
a
sure.
time of transition. Tobago, tell me your recollection of that day.
You mean Amy's Day?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was during Operation Great Storm, which was a program of action of 1993. Amy's death personally was not planned, but all the activities in the communities were thoroughly planned. If anything, our responsibility was to make our communities totally ungovernable. We will go to school. We will, at the end of the school, we will take to the street in various communities. Once we were saying maximum damage to the enemy, minimum to the Africans. In that sense, we meant anything that was in our country that benefited the state was of no use to us. It had to go up on smoke. Mm-hmm. So that was program Operation Great Storm.
And take the story on from there. You and how many others were with you that
day? There were plus minus 300 students. We did not operate in isolation. Within those students, there were militants. All the cover was being in school uniform. We had militants that were attending daily. They were going to school on a daily basis, acting as if they were normal students. And they were recruiting students to become politically active as well. There was plus minus 300 students. We had a certain formation that we'll use. We will take to the main street anything that belonged to the state, the bakery vehicles, the delivery vehicles, post office vehicles. Those, if you come across those will be pinned down. Then when it gets to a certain junction, we'll split into different units and we'll continue with the operation. Amy's car happened to drive behind the truck that was delivering drinks to the stores around the community. While the concentration was on the truck itself, somebody screamed, "Here's a settler," which was more of a bigger target. So the truck was allowed to pass through and everybody concentrated on, "Here is a settler." Mm-hmm. And our slogan of operation was, "One settler, one bullet."
And then the attack took place. It's hard for me to kind of frame the question in asking you about feelings at this particular time, but you realized that you were taking somebody's life.
The feeling was not about to kill. We were prepared to die for the cause. Mm-hmm. And in the process of that, we automatically became prepared to kill for it. Mm-hmm. You know, because many young people were dying in front of us every day. So when we're in the movement, we knew you could be shot and killed, you could be arrested. So it was a question of, I am prepared to give my life to the cause, and in the process, I'm going to pursue the targets.
When did you learn that Amy was really on your side?
During the trial in itself, you view all other information as propaganda, but during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, when you came across the Beale family and the position that they took, that it was not up to us as Americans to forgive South Africans, but it's up to you as South Africans to forgive each other. My initial reaction was, if I was a parent, there's no way I'll take that stand. These were not biological parents. There's just no way. Mm-hmm. Amy was an adoptee. So that was my first reaction. And during some walk around the commission with being escorted back to prison, they extended their hand to shake our hands. I somehow felt I did not deserve to shake their hands, not because I was viewing them as settlers, as enemies, but I just I was just in a totally different space.
There was remorse at that particular time or close to it?
Their position totally shook me off the political position, the political conviction that I had assigned my life to, totally.
I want to be sure that everyone understands, Linda, that you were not living in South Africa at the time. You were living in America, and Amy was there on her own under the Fulbright scholarship.
Yes, but we were invited to South Africa 6 weeks after Amy was killed by the city of Cape Town that wanted to show that this is still a beautiful city.
And it is.
It is. And the University of the Western Cape, where she was working and studying and, you know, centered her research, and by the people she knew. Not by the government of the day. We were told by many of our neighbors and friends, oh, you can't go there. They'll kill you. And it's like, no, we've got to see. And then I think we thought, okay, we'll do this and, you know, we'll kind of take care of our kids at home. My son was still at home at 16 and my girls were in their early 20s. You know, we would take care of our family. We would support South Africa. But when we went, we were taken into the very places where Tobacco and others grew up. And when you saw their living conditions, my 16-year-old son came out and said, he said, Mom, I'm not going in there. They hate white people. You know, they've never seen white people, and they were taken in, like, to this, you know, squatter camp. My son came out at 16 years old and took one. You know, he had little kids climbing him, taking his baseball hat, laughing with him. Took one look at him, and he said, you know, if I lived in these conditions, I would be a bit militant myself. So you see, he wasn't much younger than they were. Mm-hmm. And so it was that experience of actually going, experiencing. We didn't see so much of beautiful Cape Town at that time. And then through a series of events, we did go back. The trial was separate from the TRC. So there was a trial that ran from late October 93 to 90 through 94, and I did attend a couple of sessions just to see what it was about. It's not a jury trial. If you hear the Oscar Pistorius thing, it was very much a trial like that. So a series of things, but no, we were not living there. We're American people with kids and jobs and the whole thing.
I want to bring Manfred into the discussion. I will in a moment. Thank you for being so patient. But Tobacco, what was your sentence?
Was sentenced to 18 years in prison.
Which prison?
I was sentenced to Portsmouth, but my main home prison was Victor Fester, where Manfred was correctional officer and still is.
Well, I have to take a break. Now, we'll come back and pick the story up with Manfred and what he was thinking at the time and what he was seeing as these young people were coming across his threshold, if you will. Back in just a moment to continue our conversation, we're talking with Linda Beale, who is the mother of Amy Beale. As you've been hearing, Amy was murdered in South Africa some 21 years ago. One of those who was involved in her death is here with us in studio. Tobacco Penny is here. I hope I pronounced the name correctly.
Correct.
Tobacco, forgive me if I miss it from time to time. And Manfred Jacob also with us. He was a correctional officer who was knew Nelson Mandela and also was a guard, if you will, in the prison when Tobacco was assigned there. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get into it, if you have questions about all of this, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet, if you like, at STL on Air. Back in a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on the subject of reconciliation rather than revenge. I guess that's a broad way of putting what we're talking about today. That conversation continues in a moment, but here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A Republican-led Missouri House committee is holding hearings at this hour on three separate measures seeking to impeach Democratic Governor Jay Nixon. One hearing is about Nixon's decision to allow legally married gay couples to file joint tax returns in Missouri. Nixon has called the hearings, quote, some sort of show, unquote. A Missouri House committee is expected to advance legislation today overhauling a student transfer law for unaccredited school districts. The bill would cap the transfer costs paid by the unaccredited districts and allow accredited schools to limit how many transfer students they accept. And an Air Force staffer stationed in Illinois is making a federal court appearance this afternoon on charges that he possessed pipe bombs that he planned to unleash on local sex offenders. Justin Van Gilder has pleaded not guilty to 3 felony counts of possessing an unregistered destructive device. However, he is scheduled for a change of plea hearing in U.S. District Court in East St. Louis today. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Linda Beale. She heads the Amy Beale Foundation. It's named for her daughter, who was murdered in South Africa 21 years ago. Tobeko Penny is a man who was convicted, imprisoned, and then pardoned for Amy's murder. Manfred Jacobs, a South African corrections officer, is also with us in the studio. Manfred, again, thank you for being patient. Let me turn to you now. Can you pick up the story at the point where these young people were coming to your prison, if you will? And what were you thinking about all that had been going on?
Certainly. What I need to say, obviously I joined the department only in 1995. But we followed the story, and at the time, I could understand their frustration, because we came from a school system where we were saying we need to make school ungovernable because you cannot have normal school in abnormal society. So at the time, we felt they were correct. But during that same year, Chris Hani, you know, Secretary General of the Communist Party, died, and Nelson Mandela came to the fore where he pleaded to South Africans. We say, please, don't lose your head now. Because at the time, we said the person who identified the culprit, which, by the way, was not even a South African who did it, was a white Afrikaans-speaking lady. And because we were ANC at the time, we could understand it and we digested it. And we're saying we need not to follow that same route, because myself and Tobeko is more or less the same age. And whilst we were militant at school, we realized this is not the way to go. So eventually, when I joined up in 95 and I met with them, you know, we tried to not to treat them as criminals, albeit that I was now a correctional officer and I need to uphold the law. I realized that, you know, these guys will, in future, because the process of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was on its way, and we knew something will happen for them, and we were actually praying for them because we understand and have no knowledge about Amy or a family, or American, and their input at the time. So we just felt we need to liberate our people that suffer for this cause.
How many of these people who were involved in the attack were in the prison?
I'm aware of 2, Tobeko and Easy. They were in our correctional facility at Victor Verster, which is now Drakenstein.
How many people, Tobeko, were sentenced?
4 young men were sentenced.
Only 4 out of all of those 300 or so?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. How was it narrowed down to 4 from 300?
There were state witnesses who were able to identify 4 out of all that. I think other faces were recognized, but the addresses were not known. Mm-hmm. And according to our oath of allegiance, it was not our responsibility to surrender any information that would lead to an arrest or execution of the member of the cause. So we had to live by that oath of allegiance.
You said we could jump in, and I'm going to jump in just for a second. Tobeko is quite amazing, and we often learn from each other when we talk like this. And I have to say, one of the things I have learned is that he took responsibility for this act, because he was elected the leader of that particular youth group at the time. He was not maybe a perpetrator that actually committed the crime, but their whole process of how they dealt with rats and people ratting on each other and all this is really quite amazing, and I've learned so much about that. So as much as you use the word killer, I don't use that word killer. I think he was one of the disenfranchised young males that Amy had talked about much after Chris Hani's assassination, which happened while she was there, and she happened to have posters of Chris Hani all over the place. So, you know, as much as we tell the story cut and dry, there are all these little kind of sidebars and things that say, okay, many of them could have actually wielded a knife or thrown a stone. But I think the eyewitnesses actually came forward and really kind of picked out the sum. Tobeko actually ran away, was not tried with the other 3, because he... Well, he can tell you that story, but it's more complicated than just
Well, these stories always are.
Yes.
I mean, they get presented in such a way, and then that is repeated and perpetuated.
Right.
So my apologies for using that word, but that is basically the way Tobago that has been presented to us here.
Yeah.
Manfred, let me come back to you. You said one thing I just want to clarify, and that is you say you wanted to make the schools ungovernable.
That's correct.
How would you do that?
Well, we sometimes don't attend school at all. Mm-hmm. And if attending school, we will make sure that the children will not be in the classrooms. We will make sure that the teachers don't teach. So we try to run and do silly things, even use the lawnmowers petrol, and we make little petrol bombs, and you just throw it there because we're saying we cannot have normal schools. And at the time, the medium of teaching was Afrikaans, which was, of course, the oppression, and it was forced upon us. And we said we cannot have that normality in the schools, whereas in our society, in our homes, we don't have the same normality.
Let's talk for a moment about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I'm not sure that everyone who is listening now fully understands what that is and the role that it played. Why don't you start by telling us your impression of what that commission is?
Let me just say, first and foremost, it was a very needed and a very the platform that was created for all of us, specifically political offenders. If we did not have that process, it's basically where they say, okay, some terrible things happen, both from the ranks of the Afrikaner as well as then blacks. And in my culture, I would be then, or South Africa, I would be referred to as a colored person, a person of mixed origin. And what happened, if you committed a crime which is politically motivated, they provide a platform where you can just come forward and say, this has happened, this is my reason why I did it. There was no, the basis was not criminal, per se, the normal criminal acts. It was purely politically. And then if they are were satisfied, they will grant you amnesty. So, but I was not part of that process, just follow it.
Linda, that's an extraordinary process.
Well, Amy was quite aware of the processes that were being developed in these negotiations so that the elections could take place. She told us about a lot of these things that were about to happen. So when Parliament, when Mandela was elected and Parliament passed its bill, like our Congress. Can you imagine our Congress passing a bill about truth and reconciliation?
Not today.
But there were amazing people that were leading that country that were very wise, Mandela being one of many, by the way. We celebrate his life, but he represented many others. And Desmond Tutu, and he's well known in this country,
sure,
was the archbishop who really also from the pulpit led anti-apartheid activism. And between the government of Mandela setting up an act to create a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and naming Desmond Tutu as the chairperson, they developed a sense of dealing with not blanket amnesty, but case by case. And they set up this process of, there are many angles to the TRC, but in this case, the amnesty was, okay, if you committed a crime or maybe you were arrested or not, but you could come forward and prove that you were a card-carrying member of a political movement. It was more than a party. It was a movement with manifestos and the whole thing. And if you came forward and said, I truly am a member of this, and whatever I did was under this sort of umbrella of freedom fighters, is what they were calling themselves.
Sure.
As much as Mandela was known as a terrorist on one hand, he was also known as a freedom fighter, very similar. So when they came forward and were encouraged by their political leadership to do so, which was the sad part of the TRC, the political leadership did not always take the accountability, but the people under them, we get out and do that. So they had a platform, as Manfred said, and they could tell their stories. They were asked to, a lot of harsh questions. We had a chance to respond a little bit. It was in three languages. It was a bit complicated. But Desmond Tutu, we asked Desmond Tutu, we said there's been a date set, July 1997, for us to attend their amnesty hearing. What would you do? And he looked at us. Or actually, no, this one was on a phone call. And he said, just tell them about Amy, who she was, and speak from your heart. So we sat down, my husband and I kind of prepared ourselves in our own ways, and we decided, okay, I'm going to tell him about Amy a little bit, who she was as a person, and he had all this information about prisons and if they were released, what would happen, because he was always very prepared. And so I started saying, you know, Amy was an athletic gymnast, diver, da-da-da-da-da. And all of a sudden, the four guys that were sitting up there like this with their heads down looked up. They realized she was a human being, I think. That was, to me, I felt a turning point right there in my heart. And then we also spoke to the fact that this was a South African issue. We were Americans. We respected what South Africa was trying to do with this. And as Tutu said, we can't hope to totally heal a nation, but we can create a process. I don't think it turned out exactly as it was all meant to. There are a lot of issues about it. But what it did, it gave an institutionalized process that in our case allowed and kind of led to personal reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. Tobacco, your thoughts when all of this was going on, do you think realistically it was going to result in your, as it did, result in your release?
When we appeared in front of the commission, we were not happy about the process at all. We did not see a need to take part in this process, given the fact that what we did was not for any personal gain, and we're of the view that those who led and commanded us should appear and present our position. We were led to believe that the TRC rules where we needed to appear in person so that details of what the truth could come out, and that the PAC leadership had its position in terms of clarifying everything. As resentful as I was, we went through the process. It was not one of the best processes, but South Africa could forever be proud of such a process because it was there not to enforce but to promote the truth, reconciliation, and national healing. I doubt if I would have been sitting here in the studio with Linda today if it was not through that first step of a formal institutionalized process, because that process granted us an opportunity not to be afraid of each other, to be able to approach. Because when I was released out of prison, I was able to sort of reach out to Lena to say, here is what I'm busy doing in my freedom. Will you be able to assist? So we're able to work together till today.
Yeah, I think most people who become familiar with the story find it absolutely remarkable that this relationship has existed. How much time did you actually spend in prison?
It's been four and a half.
Four and a half years of 18.
And there was a justice. You know, people say, oh, you didn't have justice. Mm. That is not true. Mm. It went through a court process, and there was, you know, there was a sentence and the whole thing. There, it was not, you know, people say, well, you didn't have any justice. The justice was there. And sometimes things can't be put into word, but when you have opportunities in your life, we all have strange things happen. Sometimes we're afraid to take an opportunity to step out of our comfort zone. Tobacco, Easy stepped out of their comfort zone to say, hey, the Beals are over here doing some stuff. We're trying to peacefully change our community. Mm-hmm. How could we not?
Well, I think a lot of people probably would have several different answers to that. But the fact that you're saying these kinds of things, I find quite remarkable. We want to talk about what all of this has led to, because it's led to a lot of very good things, obviously. But I have to take a break in a couple of minutes. I want to come back to Manfred, a man who was an acquaintance of new Nelson Mandela, under the circumstances when he was in prison at Robben's Island. You knew him.
Certainly know of him. Yeah. But let me just say, since his release, I was able to meet on three occasions with Madiba. We were not allowed to do, as prison officials, although at the time I was not one yet, but people other than white African-speaking officials were not allowed to work with him. Mm-hmm. So even if I was in the service, I was not, would not meet with the old man. So
everybody has their impressions of this man. And when he died in December, we certainly heard a great outpouring from around the world. But you crossed paths with him on occasion. Give us your impression.
You know, the one great thing, and maybe I must refer to you, Madiba, one thing that he did.
Madiba is what people call him.
Yeah, that's his clan name. Right. One thing that he did, he brought people together. You know, our strength is certainly in our diversity. So one day when he turned 19, that's the T-shirt that I have on today, in 2008, there was on our national television, people were interviewed And they asked the question, you know, what is your wish or gift for Madiba on his 90th birthday? And a lot of people said a lot of things. And one particular nine-year-old white girl, they interviewed her. She looked straight into the camera. She just simply said, I want to give back the 27 years that he spent in prison. Now, Madiba was able to achieve exactly that, where people, you know, can, even with his death, can simply, not knowing each other, embrace each other and realize that we need to work together. We need to let to bolt on and to protect the legacy of Madiba, you know, where there's one unified South Africa. And this is what he achieved, and this is what stands off with me, making me feel appreciated, loved, and that I belong and can contribute to South Africa. And this is certainly what we try to do as a person, but also as a department.
Tobeko, your impressions of the man?
He left a very positive legacy. We were so much wish he was released quite earlier. A lot would have not taken place given his influence, positive influence. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Linda, of course, this was really quite a coming together of some really wonderful people in the leadership category at this time.
I have met people from, you know, Mandela and his comrades on down to the people on the ground. And it is still amazing. It's a gift that Amy gave me. It's an amazing experience. My life really changed 20 years ago. Well, I actually say it doesn't change. It was so enhanced by so many things. We do miss Amy, of course. But I also want to say that I met Manfred for the first time last August. We were celebrating the 20th anniversary of Amy's death. And he, when Mandela was released from Robben Island, he was then sent to Polsmore Prison and then to Victor Verster. Mm-hmm. And he had a beautiful house at Victor Verster. And Manfred is now part of a program that is allowing visitors to come through that house. It had so much history and stories, and Manfred can tell you these amazing stories about how he was treated, about how he outwitted his guards at times, and what it was like when F.W. de Klerk came in and negotiated with, you know, Mandela, and they both received the Nobel Peace Prize. So it's a very historic place, and he shares these stories. So if anyone goes to Cape Town and has an opportunity, this is priceless.
I wonder, are any of those stories going to be shared this evening during your presentation? Or do you know? I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is pretty much
certainly
off the cuff.
Certainly.
I'll tell folks that our guests are participating in a panel discussion. It's called Nelson Mandela's Legacy of Reconciliation, Lessons for Leading an Inclusive Community. That's being held at 6:30 p.m. this evening at Edward Jones Auditorium. That's at Manchester and Highway 270. This is under the sponsorship of Maryville University, by the way, but it is not at the university. It's at the Edward Jones Auditorium, Manchester and Highway 270 at 6:30 tonight. We'll have more information on that on our website at stlpublicradio.org. I have to take another break. I'll do that. We'll come back and find out what the Amy Beale Foundation is doing now, both in South Africa and in this country as well. Linda Beale is with us. She heads that foundation, named for her daughter, who was killed in South Africa 21 years ago. Tobeko Penny is with us, a man who was convicted and imprisoned for being involved in that particular incident. And Manfred Jacobs, a South African corrections officer, also with us. They'll all be participating in that event tonight at Manchester and 270. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. As we continue our conversation with Linda Beale, Tobeko Penny, and Manfred Jacobs, we're talking about the issue of reconciliation rather than revenge in association with the death of Amy Beale. And it was for Amy that the foundation was named, the Amy Beale Foundation. We've talked a lot about the things that happened leading to the establishment of that foundation, Linda. Let's talk now about the good that's come of all of that, what we've been talking about. What is the foundation up to? How does it work? And let's talk about South Africa first, and then what's going on here.
Well, my late husband and I were given opportunities with some monies and whatnot to establish the Amy Beale Foundation in South Africa as a separate one from the U.S. With these monies came a lot of strings. It was USAID money. And what are you going to do with this money? What are you going to do? So we were fortunate to have some time to research, from people at the grassroots level to people in government who ran mental health departments and whatnot. What happened after apartheid in South Africa to its youth really concerned us. Because what really did happen is people that were freedom fighters were now becoming common criminals. They had the skills to make bombs. They had a mentality to fight an oppressor. Who was the oppressor? There were all these things going on. And so we really decided our opportunity might well be within this group of young people. And when everyone said, you must start in the community where Amy was killed. Okay, what do we do? We did a lot of research, and we had very interesting experiences, and we realized they needed educational development. A lot of them weren't going to school. They didn't have job skills, so job skill creation. They needed access to more knowledgeable health issues like HIV. I mean, there were a series of things. So we tried to narrow things down to the point where we could create programs. Job creation was huge. So we tried to employ people that previously were not employed or they had good ideas but didn't have the skills. They couldn't even have a bank account in those days. Even to pay people was difficult. So through a series of programs, we developed the Amy Beale Foundation Trust. And then we, when Easy and Tobacco and others were released from prison, they saw our programs. And they said, we've got people for your programs. Some of it just came about rather naturally. And so we did welding and block making. We ran bakeries where we trained people in baking. And then the bakery trucks would go out to the community, and the community people could. We did a lot of stuff. In fact, it was quite exhausting. It's quite exhausting as I look back on it. But the end goal was for a foundation that could sustain itself. You know, so many Americans and others go in and say, look, you know, here we are, da-da-da-da-da-da, we'll start this. But what happens when you leave? It's gone. So the goal for Peter and I, and he's been gone 12 years, so that's been a while too. And then when we had people in the community that really know their communities could run programs. Of course, money has always been a part of keeping it going. But the thing about it is people think Americans are rich no matter what you say. And so now, you know, there's been enough, I think, work done and shown and assessed and all that, that the youth in these communities have been helped by our programs. Many of them are returning into teaching who attended these programs 10, 12 years ago and now are coming back teaching computer and things. So it's a give back kind of thing, but it's being run by South Africans.
Tobacco being one of those who was doing that.
Yes, indeed.
Tobacco, tell us about your involvement and what you have seen over these years as the foundation has been doing its work.
The foundation has actually provided more opportunities to young people, opportunities that we never had. So it's very fulfilling to be part of such an organization where others take the basic right of being able to swim at the age of 2 years. But in our communities, you have one swimming pool for a population of 500,000. So the foundation actually partners with private institutions, diving and swimming clubs, surfing clubs, music schools, and we simply transport these young people to realize their potential in music academically. We facilitate them to get some employment as well.
At what age do you start working with these young people?
Well, officially we start from age 7 years, but in our responsibility, we know a seven-year-old has a responsibility to go to a kindergarten to fetch a young one who happens to be 4 or 5 years. And in return, it's very difficult to say, we don't allow this five-year-old. We had to be creative, you know, to have a facility where we look after those 5, 6-year-old, because we know from ourselves that we had that responsibility. So officially it's 7 years old, but we do have 6, 5-year-olds.
We have parents involved, too, in different ways.
You've got to be flexible when you're doing something like this. I mean, you write your own rules as necessary. Yes. Is there any story that you can tell us about a particular success story with regard to any young person or a group of young people?
We had various young people who came to the U.S. and they studied here for a year and they've gone back and they've led a very successful life. So those are some of our success stories. We continue to want to partner For example, we have a hockey team that will be heading to Ireland for a hockey tournament.
So that's a huge achievement.
Yes.
Field
hockey. That's a huge achievement for the organization and for those kids as well.
Yeah. I know that not the Beale Foundation, but South Africa sent a few pretty good golfers our way.
Have dealt with the golf issue, and that is another issue. And sport in general is a political hot. You know, I mean, affirmative action in so many areas, and sport is one of them. But Manfred has been involved in a lot of the things in the prison, and its work with the sports and various activities and
through the Beale Foundation.
No, I mean, the prison is doing similar things, mm-hmm. and I think what we're trying to do is make sure we're aware of the needs, and we keep going. But I will say that Tobacco is the star of the program, okay? Can I say that?
Of course. Congratulations, star.
But I perhaps should say he's actually also one of the entrepreneurs, have his own business that obviously emanate from this process. And is diversifying now. I believe we have quite a few eggs in his bowl.
Well, tell us about that. What sort of businesses are we talking about?
Well, initially I ran a business, a meat distribution, and I'm also now into laundry, which its name is Butterfly House Laundry Services, and that name was stolen here from St. Louis.
Stolen from St. Louis?
From the Butterfly House. He was here in that Butterfly
That's
House,
right.
And that was born here.
I'll be darned. Yeah. Well, our reach is long, I guess, here from St. Louis. Manfred, look at you. You're kind of the outsider looking into this. What are your impressions of it? What, if anything, have you seen that has come of the Beale Foundation's work?
Let me just say, in South Africa, and especially in the Department of Correctional Services, we're saying that we have all a societal responsibility. And the first seat of correction certainly is the family. But in order to achieve, we need a lot of people involved because the state can't do it on its own. So when I look into what the foundation, what they did over the past few years, we try now actually to copy that, to roll out to so many other areas. Hence, we have our own, because I'm very fortunate. On our facility, we have a lot of skills development programs where we have a youth production workshop, and we also have trained inmates where they, over weekends, we try to bring youth from poor communities, and they train them in basic welding, in cabinet making, upholstery, and so forth. So we're saying that we need to equip. If we want to stop, you know, what happened in the past, that people don't have self-worth, you know, a bad self-esteem and don't have skills in general, we need to partner with the foundations, with business, and a lot of other people. So if I look, I certainly want to say thank you for what they did, but please don't stop now, because there's so many people out there in South Africa that don't have, you know, just basic education, if you can start there. They expose people to swimming. Now, swimming in our community, that's a luxury. Music, you know, formal music training, it's a luxury. You know, you might take it for granted perhaps over here. They expose people. They introduce new fields to people, and suddenly you feel, you know, there's something else that I can do. I might not be good academically. I might not be good with my hands, but hey, I can sing. I can play a guitar. You know, I can start my own business. And this is exactly what they did. And we, as a department and as a government and as South Africans, we want to say, let's partner and do more. Let's those offenders coming out of prison, still being labeled, you know, and many times we cause them to go back to prison. So we say, let's give them an opportunity by involving business and other people.
There is an expression that you may have heard, as the twig is bent, so grows the tree.
Yeah.
And that's obviously why you want to get at these young people at a very early age. Linda Manfred just said something to the effect, please don't stop now. Is there any danger that the foundation is winding down in South Africa?
No. I thought the 20th anniversary was a very kind of good handoff time. But in, you know, the whole process, it is their foundation now. And that means kind of letting go and going forward. we wanted to make the U.S. Foundation, our 501c3, an endowed foundation. We wanted to work a lot with scholarships and internships. And we've done a lot of internships, not so much in scholarships, a lot of things not run on-the-ground program like we did in South. There's nothing I like better than to go into our after-school projects, and Tobacco knows that. But I also know that I can't keep going forever. And Amy was deeply involved in human rights, human dignity, and education. And we look around our own country as well. I live here. My children live here. My grandchildren live here. So we're concerned about some of the issues that we're seeing in the U.S. I can't run program. I don't have that kind of funding. But we, again, are partnering with organizations. A good example right now in Whittier College in California, we had a grant, and part of that went into Whittier to develop an Amy Beale curriculum based on human rights. And the students at Whittier College have been developing the program. They are going to high schools in the area, which are very Hispanic and many illegals, to actually, you know, let these kids know that they have human rights. So the learning is both from the college student, the student in the schools, and it's been a second year going now. I think Irvine, California, is doing the Beale Mandela curriculum now. So it's how do you learn from our story to begin with? And if you want to, we're open about the sharing. But how do people learn to respect one another? So it will be, we're evolving. I'm not good on social media, but we have some pretty good people who have started the Amy Beale Facebook a couple of weeks ago. Our website became sort of a racial war. I mean, you know, there are difficult issues we've dealt with, but in hopes now that we can make a little bit more of an impact in our communities. And I do travel the country, by the way, trying to, you know, get people to think about these things and take positive action.
There's plenty of work to be done in this country. There's no question about that. What is your website, by the way? We'll put a link to it on ours.
We're, as I said, the website kind of had some issues, so I really haven't updated. The South African website, and there's a great information, is www.amybeale.co.za. In South Africa, they would say Z, but it's Z-A. Our Facebook is Amy Beale Foundation USA. There's also lots of Twitter and Facebook about the South African program.
Well, folks want to find you. They're not going to have any difficulty.
I don't think so. They can Google.
Yeah. We only have a couple of minutes left. And Manfred, I want to come back to you just very briefly. We talked about there are problems in this country, too. You're a newcomer here. You've never been to this country before.
Correct.
What are your impressions? What do you see that has surprised you during your short time here?
I'm here, I think it's now my third day, and what I see is a lot of goodwill. I certainly, other than the wow factor, because I'm coming from a little town in South Africa called Hermanus, and I see people who care, people who don't see the color of your skin in order to love you. And that is important, and maybe I'm not really exposed to all your people, but what I saw up till now, I'm grateful, and I want to take it back to South Africa and saying, you know, we need to do more in order to embrace one another. We need to do more in order to treat somebody that you feel special. And I want to say thank you to Mrs. Beale, but more specifically, thank you to the candles. You know, I'm a total stranger, but from the moment I walk into their house, I feel like I'm actually a child, you know, in their house. And this is what we need in our own country, where we don't judge. Because so easily, you know, when you see somebody, you judge and you already have make up your mind about the person, and that's not good.
You better tell our audience who the candles are that you just mentioned. Not everybody knows who they are.
Well, Larry and Judy Candle staying here in St. Louis, and they are also involved. I don't know the history so much, but they basically extended, because we are supposed to go to California and have their partake in a conference, and they said, you know, we also need you this side and say some of the Mandela stories. So pity the time is done. I would love to say some of the Mandela stories. But I end up here in St. Louis, and They were just good.
Well, we're glad to have you, and we hope your impression of what you've seen doesn't change during the time you're here. That's Manfred Jacobs. He's a South African who was visiting here in St. Louis, along with Linda Beale, who heads the Amy Beale Foundation, also with us in studios, to Obegu Penny, a man who was involved in the death of Amy Beale 21 years ago. I'll remind everyone that they're participating in a panel discussion tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the Edward Jones Auditorium at Manchester and Highway 270. More information on that at our website. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Continue. Good luck to you, Linda, with the foundation. To you, too, DeBaco, for the work that you're doing. And Manfred, thank you so much for your kind words about our country.
Thank you.
Great to see you
thank
all.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the local real estate market as the home buying season heats up. And we'll talk about the contribution of famous explorers Lewis and Clark to the St. Louis after they returned from their famous expedition out west. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.